This is an interview with John Campbell. John worked with Hansard in Old Parliament House from 1960 to 1988. He will be speaking with me, Edward Helgeby, for the oral history program conducted by Old Parliament House. On behalf of the Chief General Manager of Old Parliament House, I would like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this program. Do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but the closure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the form of consent?
Yes, I understand that.
This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript of this recording should Old Parliament House decide to make one?
Yes.
We hope that you will speak as frankly as possible, knowing that neither the tapes nor any transcript produced from them will be released without your authority. This interview is taking place today on Thursday, 27 March 2008. Can we begin with, when and where were you born?
I was born in Brisbane on the 25th of February 1935.
Did you attend school in Brisbane as well?
Yes, all my schooling was done in Brisbane. We lived in one of the inner western suburbs of Brisbane, which originally was part of Paddington, but later the postal address was changed to Baden. And the street in which we lived happened to be in the same street as the local school. So I attended that school, the Ithaca Creek State School, all through my primary education. At the end of the primary school in Queensland, we sat for an examination, which was called the scholarship examination. If you passed that, you were entitled to go on to a government secondary school without the payment of fees, which I did. I then attended the State Commercial High School, which was one of four schools, high schools operating in Brisbane at that stage under a very strange system where there was a domestic science high school, obviously attended by girls. There was an industrial high school, not quite so obviously, but in fact attended by boys. There was also the Brisbane State High School, which was, I guess, a more academic high school designed partly for students who had intentions of going on to higher education. I didn't attend that school. I went to the State Commercial High School, which, unlike the first two schools, had a mixture of boys and girls, but a very large majority of girls. There were very few boys in the school, so I did my secondary schooling at that State Commercial High School.
Did you go on to other further education after you left school?
Yes, but only on a part-time or external basis. My main education, of course, was to pursue my shorthand studies. And perhaps you might like me to talk in more detail about that later. But on the other hand, I decided to study accounting. So I went to night school, did a certificate in accountancy through the University of Queensland. Because I had not matriculated, because I did only 2 years of high school, I was initially ineligible to undertake a degree, but my certificate in accounting gave me matriculation into the commerce faculty of the University of Queensland. So I then proceeded to do some additional subjects, in the hope that one day I'd complete a Bachelor of Commerce degree, but I didn't finish that. I did finish sufficient of the subjects to get what was known as a diploma in commerce, but not a bachelor's degree.
After you left school, what was your first job?
My very first job was as an office boy or trainee reporter in the State Reporting Bureau. In those days in Queensland, the Queensland government had what was known as the State Reporting Bureau, which was responsible for providing the official records of the higher courts and also of the parliament. So the court reporters and the Hansard reporters were combined in the one organisation. And the offices of that bureau were in Parliament House. So my first job was, in fact, as an office boy and trainee reporter in the Queensland Parliament House.
Well, that almost answers, I think, the next question I was going to have, which was, how did you come to work at Old Parliament House? And what sort of skills do you really think you would bring to that job?
I had learnt shorthand as part of my high school course, and because I had done reasonably well in that, I was offered the position of office boy and trainee reporter in the State Reporting Bureau. That was at the beginning of 1950. I spent then 2.5 years training, so that by the middle of 1953, I applied for a position of reporter on the State Reporting Bureau. I was successful with that application, and for the next 7 years, I worked as a court reporter, an official court reporter, in various parts of Queensland. In the course of those years, I was working with men, and they were all men at that time, some of whom decided to move from the Queensland State Reporting Bureau to the Commonwealth Hansard staff. And some of them were very experienced reporters in Queensland. In fact, one of them had gone through the system and become one of the Hansard reporters. They were the senior group of about half a dozen of the reporters who were specifically allocated to Queensland Hansard. So when I saw these very experienced reporters moving from Queensland to the Commonwealth, I took an interest in that. And in 1960, there was an advertisement in the newspapers for a position of Hansard reporter here in Canberra. I applied. I was then 25 years old, much, much younger than any of the other reporters who had previously been appointed to that staff. I was successful in that application, and I came to work here at Old Parliament House on the Hansard staff on the 23rd of August 1960.
That must have been quite a real move to move yourself. And were you married at the time?
No, I was single. And it's always been of interest to me to remember the advertisement that was in the press. It advertised for a reporter, and it said that a house would be made available to the successful applicant. But of course, when I, as a single man, was successful in gaining the position, there really wasn't any mention of the house. In fact, I wasn't interested in living in a house on my own, so that didn't come into the appointment and my taking up the position at all. I had spent quite a bit of time away from home because in the course of working as a court reporter in Queensland, I worked all around the state, mainly on the coast, in places such as Mackay, Townsville and Cairns. So I was quite accustomed to living away from home. And when I came to Canberra, the department arranged for me to live in Lawley House in Brisbane Avenue. So I was quite, well, to the extent that that was a government hostel offering full board and lodging, and was a little different from the hotels in which I used to stay around Queensland, but in many respects it was quite similar. So in that respect, it wasn't a major adjustment. But of course, having worked in places such as Cairns and Townsville in particular for quite extended periods, coming to live here in Canberra was a bit of a culture shock, a culture shock, but also a climatic shock. I'd never seen snow or frost, anything like Canberra, and I always remember that my father came down to visit shortly after I arrived in Canberra, and my car had been parked out in the open outside Lawley House, and when he went out early one morning and saw the car with frost all over it, although he'd grown up in Scotland as a boy, he was absolutely astounded at the difference in climate.
Mm. But going back one little step, did you have any job interview for the job? Were you brought down here for a job interview? Or?
No. I actually have most of the papers still in my possession concerning my appointment and the arrangements that were made. The way it worked was that I applied. I received a letter from the principal parliamentary reporter, who at that stage was a man called Leo O'Donnell, and he advised me that he would be coming up to Queensland. Remember that this was in the middle of the year, so he was making his almost annual visit to northern climes, and he arranged to interview me at Parliament House in Brisbane. I must say that my recollection of the interview is that it was very short, because I had a reasonable understanding of the job from the conversations I'd had with colleagues I've mentioned who had come from the same staff I'd been working on to work on the staff here in Canberra. It wasn't necessary for him to go into a lot of detail about the job and that sort of thing. Obviously he had my application. So the interview consisted mainly of an actuality test. He had tape recordings of two speeches, one by Sir Alan Fairhall, who at that time was the chairman of the Public Works Committee, and he presented a report on the construction of the Royal Canberra Hospital. And one of the recordings was his speech in presenting that report. Alan Fairhall was a quite rapid speaker, but a very good speaker, put his sentences together well. So that was more a shorthand speed test. The other passage was from Sir Wilfred Kent Hughes, who was a very distinguished member, but in the opinion of many people, not a very good public speaker. Inclined to not finish his sentences, not always make his arguments clear. And in effect, the instruction I was given was, this one is not a speed test. We want you to make this a rational report and make any necessary changes to produce a rational report. So I very nervously took down in shorthand those two speeches and then transcribed them. And I still have my transcripts of those speeches. But obviously I did well enough to be appointed.
What sort of pitman speed did you have at that time, do you think?
I had an official certificate from the business college, which did a lot of the training of the reporters in Brisbane. And that certificate was for 200 words a minute. But I had also, not long before I applied to come here, passed a test, shorthand test, at 210 words a minute.
And the minimum requirement for Hansard staff here was 200 words?
Well, I wouldn't say that there was any minimum requirement as such. At that time, they were relying on these actuality recordings, and obviously that speech of Sir Alan Fairhall's was used as a good way of testing the shorthand speed of an applicant.
So when you've sort of, you moved down to Canberra, you had not been here before when you came to take up the job?
I had passed through on Christmas holidays, but that was all. Yeah. I hadn't spent any time in Parliament House, certainly when it was sitting, because any time I was here, I think there were a couple of occasions when I had come down here on school holiday, on holidays, and that was at Christmas time, when the house was not sitting.
So what did it feel like when the first day you walked into this building, which you had never been in before?
Well, that was one of the really good things that happened to me when I came here. A chap by the name of Joe McKnight, he was one of my colleagues in Brisbane, a much more mature man than I was. And he was one of the colleagues I mentioned before who had come to work here on the Hansard staff in the mid-50s. And when he heard that I had been appointed, he wrote to me and offered all sorts of assistance to send me any material about the lists of members and senators and ministers, and a little bit of material about how the Hansard system worked. Gave me directions because I was driving from Brisbane. And as I say, he gave me all sorts of encouragement and assistance. And I was due to take up my appointment on the Monday of the second week of the budget session. That would have been, I think, the 22nd of August. I think that's the right date. I left Brisbane in the middle of the previous week, actually on the show day holiday, what in Brisbane's called the Eka. That was a holiday, so I left on that day and drove down on that day and the following day. So I arrived here on the afternoon of the Thursday of the first sitting week in that sessional period. When I got here in the afternoon, I thought the houses are sitting, or at least the House of Reps will be sitting tonight, so I will go over to Parliament House and find Joe McKnight and just say hello. So I did that after dinner, and I came in and found my way in to the front desk, and it was arranged for Joe McKnight then to come to meet me, and he then took me down to the Hansard offices and took me into the principal parliamentary reporter's office, into Leo O'Donnell's office, just to pay my respects to him. And then after that, Joe said to me, would you like to go up into the House of Reps chamber? And I said, well, that sounds to me like a good idea. Because I had no familiarity at all with the chambers. So he duly took me up into the Reps chamber, and we went in through the opposition side door, and as you go in that door there are a couple of chairs on the left hand side, and we sat down there, and I was able to observe the proceedings. We hadn't been there very long when a very tall, elegant figure came through the door and just looked over to his left and glanced down and saw Joe McKnight, and he saw me. And he said, oh, hello, you must be the new lad from Brisbane. And I said, yes, I am. And of course, that was Gough Whitlam. And so that that was actually my my introduction on the Thursday evening of the week before I actually took up my appointment the following Monday.
Quite an introduction, and a happy meeting with the politician, a well-known politician even at that time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's indicative of the interest that Gough Whitlam had in the parliamentary staff, and in particular the Hansard staff, because he regarded Hansard as a very useful instrument in his political life.
So this was sort of before you started officially. What was your when was your first day in the chamber actually doing the job?
Well, I have here in my hand my first shorthand notebook. This is the notebook I used on the Tuesday, remembering that the Parliament in those days was accustomed to sitting on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays. So I don't remember what I did on Monday, but I think I probably came in and just found my way around the building and became accustomed to who was who, and some of the reference points and aids that I would be wanting to use in the future. But on the Tuesday was my first day, and I was allocated to the Senate, and the Senate met at 3 o'clock. And in those days, it was the custom for both houses to have question time at the beginning of each sitting day. So I was allocated to the Senate and was scheduled to take my first turn, as we always described these periods when we were in the chamber, at 3:10. For just 5 minutes, and that was, of course, part of question time in the Senate.
What, can you recall at all what it felt like? Did you feel, comfortable with it, or was it a stressful
time? I was most uncomfortable. It was stressful. I was exceedingly nervous, so much so that period of question time that I was reporting was not in any way difficult, I was so nervous that I was just unable to cope with transcribing that first 5 minutes on my own. And perhaps it's necessary then to mention that the way the system worked was that each reporter for each turn was allocated a supervisor. And my supervisor for that turn, for instance, was a man by the name of Bill Bridgman. He was able to, when I came downstairs to the Hansard offices, he was there at the door to meet me, knowing that I would be a bit nervous and might need some help. And he was able to help me through that by checking through my notes. And because he had been able to listen to the proceedings over the internal sound reticulation system in the building, he was able to make a check note of the turn that I had taken for that 5 minutes. And he was able to help me, in effect, reconstruct my shorthand notes. And then I was able to go on and transcribe that 5 minutes of question time.
You mentioned the sound reticulation system. Was that already introduced in throughout the building at that time? Or was it just down to the Hansard office or someplace like that?
It was certainly to the Hansard office, and I haven't a clear recollection as to other parts of the building. Obviously, because since 1946, the proceedings of the two houses had been broadcast, anybody with a radio in Parliament House was able to take to listen to the proceedings. But of course, that was of only one house. The ABC broadcast only one house at a time. And in those early days, because the houses were sitting on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, the practice was for the ABC to broadcast the House on Tuesdays and Thursdays and the Senate on Wednesday. So as it happened, I was in the Senate on Tuesday, so there wouldn't have been the broadcast. But we certainly had the sound reticulated to the Hansard offices, but I'm not really aware of the extent of that reticulation around the building.
Was this recorded as well, or was it purely a speaker supplied system?
In those days, and remember we're talking about the early 1960s, tape recording was in its relative infancy, and all we had in the Hansard office was two very large reel-to-reel tapes, and one was used to record the proceedings of the Senate and the other to record the proceedings of the House. But there were only those two recorders, and they had to be kept going. So there was no way you could stop the recording and listen to your section of the proceedings. So that was why the supervisors who were allocated to the respective reporters made shorthand check notes of the relevant proceedings, particularly if there was a new reporter, such as I was, or there was some very fast speaker, or some difficult speaker, some complicated debate. It was the practice for the supervisors to make almost complete, if not complete, check notes of those passages of the proceedings.
I understand that there was also at the table a senior Hansard reporter. Now, so therefore, and that person would also make brief notes, I understand, for indeed on interjections and other issues, so that to assist the reporter who was actually doing the full transcript.
That's right. Now, firstly, on occasions, senior officer in the chamber could be the supervisor for the reporter who was in the chamber at that time. So supervisor could make a check note as he thought was appropriate and necessary for that reporter. But at other times that wasn't the case. And in any case, some of the functions of that senior officer were, firstly, to be a contact point for Hansard with members of the House. It wasn't all that common, but not really unusual for a member to want to have some contact with Hansard. And because there was a senior officer there at the table, that was a quite convenient point of contact. So it was a liaison function to that extent, but that was a minor part of that person's job. The more important parts were to help the reporter to record interjections and also to note the name of the interjector. That was a most important thing because in the days when we were writing handwritten shorthand, we had our heads down. Later, when the stenotype machine came in, it was quite common for the stenotype operator to have his or her head up and able to see who made the interjection. So that was a useful aid to have the senior reporter there helping the reporter with interjections and the names of the interjectors. And another role that senior officer played, which varied quite considerably over the years, was to assist the reporter in the continuity of the proceedings, to know who had been the preceding speaker, because often a member would say, the honourable member who preceded me in the debate said so and so and so and so, but he wouldn't actually name who that preceding member had been. So sometimes the senior officer would have been there for a longer period, of course, than the reporter and would be able to identify that previous speaker. Also, in some of the more complex debates, the senior officer was able to keep notes and keep track of the stage of the proceedings that was had been reached. I can remember at least one significant occasion when there was a major debate. I think it was on legislation to amend the Crimes Act. And there were very many government amendments incorporated in the legislation and many, many opposition amendments. And the senior officer was able to have a complete set of these amendments. And as the respective amendments were being dealt with, he would tear out that amendment and pass it over to the reporter. And that sort of thing was very useful in helping the reporters to make a coherent report. It's a little bit of a side issue, but I might just mention it at this point, that there were lots of things included in Hansard which were not actually spoken in the House. For instance, in the instance I'm talking about now, when an opposition amendment came to be moved, it was the practice to put up in Hansard the clause of the bill to which the opposition was moving the amendment, so that when that amendment appeared in Hansard, you were able to go back straight away and see the amendment in the proper context. So that's one example of the many respects in which the Hansard record finally produced is not a completely verbatim record of the proceedings. And that is an example of the type of assistance that the senior officer sitting in the chamber was able to give to the reporter who had the primary responsibility for recording that part of the proceedings.
Tell me, what did a typical day at work, what was it like for you?
Well, if you don't mind, I might try to cover a week in those early days. As I've mentioned, the general pattern of sitting was Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursdays. So often Monday was not a sitting day, and in fact we were not required to attend in the office if we had no work to do. So sometimes on a Monday a few of us were able to go off and have a game of golf or do all sorts of things at home. In my case, I might be doing a little bit of laundry or anything like that. And Monday was often a free day. And then because both houses didn't sit until Tuesday afternoon, quite often a committee would meet on a Tuesday morning. And when committees held public hearings and called witnesses, part of our job was to provide a record of those committee meetings. So not every Tuesday, but reasonably often, even in those early days before the really large committee work got underway, even in those early days, we would often be in on a Tuesday morning reporting a committee. And then because I had full board and lodging at Lawley, I would often have lunch at Lawley and then come over to Parliament House, because the reps would start at 2:30 and the Senate would not start until 3 o'clock. And then they would sit through the afternoon. The reps tended to go through until 6 o'clock. The Senate often would finish the afternoon sitting by, say, 5:30, 5:45, somewhere about that time. And then basically the dinner break was between 6 and 8. So both houses would resume at 8 o'clock. And then we would just stay here until the last house finished. Because although we were allocated to one of the two houses, once one house got up, as was the expression we used, always used, finished sitting for the day, and that was often the Senate, the whole reporting team would then work on the continuing house. And often the Senate would finish around 10, 10:30, something like that. On the other hand, the reps was inclined to go a little bit later, 11, 11:30, and occasionally into the early hours of the next morning.
In those cases, when you went to staff, Senate had closed down and you were still saying the reps, did they change the turns, or were you still working on these 5-minute turns and simply longer breaks in between times?
We would start off the day working 5-minute turns, and that was a really good practice because it got all members of the staff working fairly quickly, and it enabled the copy to be sent down to the government printer more quickly, and therefore to enable the government printer to get underway earlier in the printing of the Hansard. And then after one round of 5 minute turns, we would change over to 10 minute turns. And while ever the two houses were sitting, we would stay on 10 minute turns. But then once one house finished, particularly if the Senate, for instance, had not finished until about 10 or 10:30, then we would come down to 5 minute turns on the House of Reps. And that, again, was a good practice because it meant that when the last house finally got up, there wasn't somebody who was left with a full 10-minute turn, which was going to take another hour and a half, 2 hours to clear. Whereas working only 5-minute turns, that person was left with only half of that extra time.
I just wonder the question. I mean, so you might have 10-minute turns even during question time, which is usually a fairly intense period of a lot of talking and much more action often than you would find at other times. You still had 10-minute terms.
Not so much in those days, because particularly in the Senate, it would be rare for question time to go for 3/4 of an hour, and often the House of Reps question time would not go longer than 3/4 of an hour, which was, if we had a full staff, in the Reps it was 9 reporters, so that was 9 times 5, 45 minutes for the first round. When I started, we often had only 7 reporters on the Senate, and even so, question time would finish in the first round on many occasions. The Senate was a much, much different place in the 1960s from what it has become in more recent years. So I was up to Wednesday evening, which quite often could extend into the early hours of Thursday. I didn't mention that after the Tuesday sitting, of course, the Daily Hansard was produced overnight. So although the House of Reps didn't start until 2:30 on the Wednesday afternoon, and again the Senate at 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, we were required to do a proofreading of the Daily Hansard that had been produced overnight by the government printer. And what happened was that the two books were split up over the reporting staff, and each reporter was allocated a certain number of pages, and he was required to not to proofread it in the sense of checking the printed copy against the typewritten copy, but a proofreading in the sense of checking it through for any printing errors or perhaps any errors that we Hansard staff had made. And generally looking for any errors of all sorts that might be made, have been made in that Daily Hansard. So we did that during the morning of the Wednesday, and then worked through Wednesday afternoon and evening. And then on Thursday, the House of Reps met at 10:30, and the Senate met at 11. And again, on Thursday mornings, we had Wednesday's Daily Hansards to proofread. So we used to come in reasonably early on Thursday morning so that we would be there as soon as the advance copies. We used to get advance copies of the Daily Hansard, that we were able to get to work to proofread. So Thursday morning from 10:30 or 11 through to lunchtime, and then into the lunch break was usually about an hour and a quarter or an hour and a half, from about quarter to 1 or 1 o'clock till 1 o'clock until 2:30, either 2:15 or 2:30, I've forgotten just now. And then we'd work through the afternoon. But then it was not unusual for the Senate to adjourn for the week at about 4:30, 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. So then we would all switch over onto the House of Reps, which would always, or nearly always, continue sitting on Thursday evening and go through till any time, 11, 11:30, midnight, sometimes into the early hours of Friday morning. And then, of course, on Friday morning, we had Thursday's daily Hansards to proofread. And very occasionally, there might be a committee that we had to staff on a Friday. But usually, the senators, those who wanted to leave Canberra, left on Thursday night. And the members, again, those who wanted to leave Canberra, left early on Friday morning. So it was not common for committee meetings. So once we had completed our proofreading tasks on Friday morning, usually able to get through that by lunchtime, again, we were free and again, not required to stay in the office on Friday afternoons.
You mentioned you used the term proofreading. At some point, there is some editing also taking place of to remove ambiguities and repetitions, repetitive language in before the Hansard is produced. So who would, so that from what you were saying, the reporters did not do that?
Yes.
Was that the job done by the senior Hansard staff?
By both. If you don't mind, I might just refer to this little book, which is called Commonwealth Hansard, Its Establishment and Development. And this copy that I have is the third edition, which was produced by Bill Bridgman, the chap I mentioned earlier, who was my first supervisor. And this little book contains a definition of Hansard. I've mentioned that contrary to the view of many people, Hansard is not a strictly verbatim report, and that's exactly what this piece of text says. And if you don't mind, I'll just read this small section. Hansard is not a strictly verbatim report. The aim of the Hansard reporter is to produce a rational verbatim report. A report which, in the definition given in May's parliamentary practice, and then this is a quote, though not strictly verbatim, is substantially the verbatim report, with repetitions and redundancies omitted, and with the obvious mistakes corrected, but which, on the other hand, leaves out nothing that adds to the meaning of the speech or illustrates the argument. That's the end of the quote. And we here in Canberra unofficially added a few words there to say, and does not add anything unnecessarily. So I hope that conveys the fact that, as that quote says, it was the job of the reporter to do some of the editing. And that was done at various points. The first point was in actually writing the speech in shorthand. As the member was speaking, it was sometimes possible to make editorial changes as you were reporting the speech in shorthand. Then the second point, of course, is in transcribing your shorthand note, and that is probably the point at which most of the editing was done. Once the practice was that once the reporter's transcript had been made and the reporter had checked it through, checked any quotations, checked any significant references, checked any factual statements about which the reporter might have some doubt, once all those editorial changes had been made, the reporter's transcript was submitted to his supervisor. And often that supervisor had listened to the reporter's turn and often had taken a check note of it. So the supervisor was then in a position to go through the reporter's transcript, and depending on the quality of the reporter and the experience ability of the reporter, the supervisor would check it very closely, or maybe if he was happy with the standard of the reporter, would just give it a quick run through. And that was again another opportunity for editorial changes to be made in the light of that senior officer's long experience on the staff. And in my case, obviously, when I started, my supervisor, who most of the time in the early piece was Bill Bridgman, he'd been here for 30 years and was one of the most knowledgeable and one of the best qualified persons on the staff. So he was able to help me really wonderfully.
Did the supervisors actually take a turn in the chambers as well, or were they solely focused on being supervising the output from the reporters?
When I started, there were three very senior official positions. There was the principal parliamentary reporter, it was called the second reporter, but shortly after I came, that was changed to assistant principal parliamentary reporter. And then there was a third position, and initially he was called the third reporter. They had some administrative functions. And then there were three positions called supervisor. But all six of those men worked as supervisors of the reporter's turns and as the senior officer in the chamber. The three administrative type positions did much less of that work than the supervisors, so-called. And often, especially when one house got up and we're working on one house, those three very senior officers, as we used to say, would go off the book, and the supervisors, and say two or three of the most senior and most experienced reporters would get a bit of experience and training as supervisors. So that supervisory work was done by all those people.
Just stepping back a little bit from the formal day, you mentioned that, I mean, during the, you've had a morning sitting, you have lunch break, and then you come back again, or you have in the afternoon, there's a dinner break. Where do you go on to have your meals?
Well, when I came here in 1960, the staff facilities were brilliant. Here, on this level where we are now, on the main level, on this House of Rep side of the building, adjacent to the members' dining room area, there was a staff dining room. And it was a silver service dining room, linen tablecloths, and the whole box and dice. I'd say almost the same members, the same menu, as was provided in the members' dining room. And there was a table in that staff dining room which was allocated to the Hansard staff. So particularly at dinner times, we could come in and in a rotation or progressively as people finished their afternoon's work, the Hansard people would come in and have their dinner in the staff dining room. And we were paid a meal allowance, which was based on the charges in the staff dining room. So it was very good value for money in the staff dining room. And that dining room was also open at lunchtime. So we could, if we had time, but quite often on a Thursday, for instance, would be very unusual for you to have time to go into the dining room and have lunch. You could do it on a Tuesday or a Wednesday if you wanted to, but because I was living at Lawley and was paying for my full board and lodging, and my name being Campbell and of Scottish extraction, I would, if I had the chance, go back to Lawley and have some of my meals there. But the staff dining room was really a very very good facility, staff facility to have available to us.
You mentioned there was a table for a report for the reporters. Did that mean there was in some way some segregation between the classes of staff who worked there, that reporters in that corner and other staff in that corner and so forth?
I think that's right. Of course, the number of people in this building in the 60s was very, very much smaller than it grew to in later years. I remember that the Parliamentary Library, for instance, had a very small staff. I wouldn't have been surprised if the number of staff actually in the library area was in single figures. We mixed a little with the people in the other departments, but I think in many respects we tended to stick to our own offices. But certainly in the whole building there was a bit of segregation. If you think of the members area, for instance, the members dining room and the members bar was available to only the senators and members. And then there was the area of the dining room and a small area outside, which was available to senators and members and their guests. But except on very rare occasions, unless you were a guest of a member of a senator or a senator, the staff were not able to eat in those areas. And then there was the staff staff dining room. So there was that, there was segregation to that extent. Of course, after the 1965 extension on this House of Representatives side of the building was constructed, that staff dining room was taken over as a committee room, and the staff cafeteria was provided on the lower ground floor adjacent to the non-members bar. So there was a big change in the late 1960s from the silver service linen tablecloths staff dining room to the cafeteria style. And I